Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Because I'm a truth sayer, you're going to get the truth.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 144, a talk with Adrian Miller. Adrian is currently the manager of Anderson .Paak, the rapper, singer, and musician who rose to stardom after his show-stopping appearances on Dr. Dre's new album, Compton, a soundtrack by Dr. Dre. But there's a lot more to his story than helping to guide Anderson from obscurity to overseas tours and appearances on The Tonight Show. Adrian, as you'll hear, was at the epicenter of the Los Angeles rap scene throughout the 1990s. He worked closely with labels like Delicious Vinyl and Immortal Records, and played a key role in the rise of acts like Coolio, Freestyle Fellowship, Funkdubiast, Cypress Hill, House of Pain, The Far Side, and many, many more. His time in L.A. reads like a who's who of artists, producers, executives, and even movie moguls, as his longtime friendship with Straight Outta Compton director F. Gary Gray will attest. After helping to get the L.A. rap scene on its feet, Miller took a job at Warner Brothers as the senior vice president of A&R, working directly under legendary executive and manager to the stars, Benny Medina. We talked with Adrian via Skype while he was on tour with Anderson in Europe. Because of the hectic pace of life on the road, you may occasionally hear people in the background of our conversation. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our talk with another key member of the 1990s LA rap scene, DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill, on episode 30. Speaking of our archive, if you want us to add to it by making new episodes, visit patreon.com/thecipher show and become a patron. Even a dollar a month can go an awful long way. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now here's the man who knows everyone, and I do mean everyone, Adrian Miller. So can you tell me a little bit just about yourself? Like, where'd you grow up? What'd your parents do? That kind of basic stuff.
I'm originally from St. Louis, Missouri, and I went to Ferguson Middle School. Yeah, tell me about it. No one knew about that place. But I will say this. It has always been what it is.
Yeah. The dynamics have always been the same there from when you were growing up.
Yeah, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed since Mike Brown. Nothing's going to change. And that's sad, but, you know, I don't want to digress and go into a whole nother conversation. But I was able to see a different world, I guess you could say, because my mom married her high school sweetheart when I was about 5 years old and moved to L.A. So then I moved to Los Angeles. But I was a little troublemaker and got sent back to St. Louis at about 13 and basically went to school there, left when I could possibly leave. I'm headed out as far west as I could go, making it to Tulsa. I got a little scholarship at TU and was at Tulsa University and got into doing radio and DJing and being a part of that whole thing that I could do as much as I could while I was in college to kind of like forge my way into what we saw burgeoning as this movement, this hip hop thing. To say the least, you know, I had to get an education because I just didn't want to end up not in a position to get a job. I was getting an education to get a job, not for the sake of saying I'm, you know, well-spoken or I'm acknowledging, you know, etiquette or even understanding economy or policies of different regions. It was more about less culture, more about just get a plain job, be better than most of the people I grew up in and around. And that was my whole, like, goal at the time. You know, my mom was very much a go-getter, always a self-sufficient, independent entrepreneur. And her husband was an entrepreneur. So I learned how to kind of, you know, be my own boss at a young age. And I was always, you know, doing something, whether it was Olympic Sales Club that I got involved with on the back of the comic books, to kind of running my own businesses around the neighborhood. From summer times, we would have a cutting grass service that I would hire all the kids to take my routes. So I would invent a way that I had multiple routes. And so I always had to have a kind of bulletin going around to the school when I was selling candy to the kids. Like, hey, you know, I'm selling this candy, but I also got this route for you later if you want to take it. And that turned out to be a wee bit of a debacle, because I was trying to juggle too many things along with school. And my mom was always like, you're going to be a little entrepreneur. So I was always on that vibe of, yeah, you know, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. That's what I'm going to be.
Yeah. Now, you were playing hip hop on the radio in 1990 in Oklahoma. And just, you know, just even saying that sentence sounds kind of weird. How did that whole thing happen?
Well, I was a dancer, and in it, I always enjoyed the music that I was hearing in and around me. And it happened to be the culture of what was moving. And, you know, we were into the music long before I was able to even reach a radio station. So I was way up on, you know, hip hop when it started to seep out. When we got a hold of it in Los Angeles, you know, it was probably 1978 when I heard my first hip hop break and saw some guys popping at Jesse Owens Park. At the time, it was Sportsman's Park. And it blew me away. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I mean, entrepreneurship aside, I didn't know how to put the two together, obviously, at that time, because it was just like, oh, I'm 7 years old. I want a break. I want to be a part of that. And my mom used to just tell me, like, just go to school and get a job. And yeah, so if you go all the way to Tulsa, I was on the radio in college. I had a job at Steinmart. I was working at Steinmart selling women's shoes, and I heard this guy on the radio. It was an access radio call, KBLK. It was an AM frequency. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying to myself, this guy sounds like such a clown. No disrespect to the guy. I forgot his name. Actually, I remember his name, but we're going to keep him for now. And he just couldn't speak. He couldn't articulate. He couldn't connect. He couldn't do a lot of things. And I just felt like the music choice he had was all obscure. And I'm like, wow, I'm playing better music on college radio. So my aunt's best friend had hired me on a summer program. I remember her telling me her brother owned the radio station. I was like, well, I'm going over there. And I just told the people at Steinmark I was on break. And they were like, when are you coming back? I was like, I'm probably not coming back. And just left off break and went to the radio station. And Eddie Harris, God rest his soul, in his spirit, he said, you can get a job here. And he gave me the broom and a dustpan and said, get to work.
Edwin M. Harris Jr., also known as DJ Rappin' Eddie, was a decades-long presence on the Tulsa radio scene and the general manager of KBLK.
Wow.
And it was the funniest thing ever, but I went to work and I never left that spot until I was graduated from school and on my way to LA to get a promotions job with a guy named Paul Stewart.
Paul Stewart, former guest on this show. Actually, I was going to ask, I know that you had a relationship with him when you ended up in LA. So what did you do when you got to LA? How'd you end up at Immortal? Did that happen first or did other stuff happen before then?
No, there was a lot of pieces to that puzzle. I mean, I got the job working for Paul because my cousin, who I always tag team just what was going on in LA, he was in LA. He was working at an accounting firm, and I was just really proud of him. And I said, dude, you know, these people keep calling me to play their records. I'm going to game them into giving you an internship and we can get into business. And he was just like, you're not going to be able to do it. And I was like, yeah, watch what happens. And then the guys from Delicious Vinyl had become friendly with me, because I'm by that time I had gotten the station to become a Billboard reporting station. So all the record labels were like, oh, we can go get a quick ad from those guys in Tulsa. And they could, because I was the music director. So for all intents and purposes, I was just about the music. But then I started to understand that I had a little juice with a couple of people at the record companies. So I got my cousin an internship at Delicious Vinyl. Paul Stewart was doing street teaming for Delicious Vinyl. And I knew Paul from the party scene. You know, I had already approached Paul on one of my breaks during Christmas. I went up to him and I said, hey, you got that job ready for me. I'm coming back to L.A. And Paul just laughed at me. He was just like, yeah, little man, I got you, whatever. It's all good. Paul's roommate in Sonoma State is a guy named Fabian Duvernay. And you take the parallels of Paul Stewart doing street teaming for Delicious Vinyl, Mike Ross, and a guy who did radio for those guys, Steven Rifkin.
Oh, wow.
Steve Rifkin is one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the hip-hop industry. He's a second-generation record man. His father signed acts like James Brown and Millie Jackson. He has a number of different projects over the years. He's managed New Edition, founded Loud Records and SRC Records, put out films, and even invested in educational DVDs for children. He helped launch the careers of Wu-Tang Clan, Big Pun, Mobb Deep, Akon, and many more. He also helped to pioneer the concept of the street team as a promotional tool.
And it all starts to come together. Steve Rifkin hired Paul's roommate, Fabian DuVernay. He left working at Delicious Vinyl, created the Steve Rifkin Company. Fabian was one of the people blowing. He was one of the record company people calling me on a regular basis in Tulsa. Paul's guy. Everybody was getting a job at a label or something like that back then. And we're talking 91, 92-ish. And I was fresh out of school. I came to L.A., and I got the job because Paul's partner at the time, Malik, had to leave and go get a job because, you know, we were making money, but it wasn't like something consistent. So you thought you were going to make a little money until one of the labels hired you. That was the whole key to success as a street team guy. And we were doing street teaming then before Steve decided, hey, I'm going to call it street teaming and take off on it. We were actually the street team company. And it's so funny because on Gardner and Melrose, if you're familiar with Los Angeles, Paul lived on Gardner. Mm-hmm. Steve's office was on Gardner, right across the street. So it wasn't a day that went by that I didn't see Steven, Lisa, and Fabian in their office. And we were across the street, myself, Paul, Shane Mooney, Malik, Skate Master Tate, et cetera, et cetera. So I got the job working for Paul. And then because I don't know if we slept. I don't remember sleeping back then. But I got into town, and the hottest club in L.A. was a party called Brass. Brass was done by Marcus Wyatt, Paul Stewart, and Orlando Aegean. It was the beginning of the acid jazz movement in L.A. And it was hip-hop, jazz, and they would do dance music. And Marcus is a huge house DJ now. Orlando went on to become one of the greatest A&R guys ever. Now he's in the art world, and then now you know who Paul is, obviously. But I got into town and rushed over and got together with Paul. And Paul was like, okay, you're going to do the street teaming side of the company, blah, 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 blah. And I'm going to rest. And Paul would sleep until like noon. And I was up working at 8 o'clock in the morning in his house, tinkering around. And his roommate used to get pissed because he was a DJ late at night. And he slept late because they would stay up late, you know, doing parties and stuff.
Right. Amazing. And so how'd you and your cousin, somewhere in all this, you and your cousin meet up and just basically discover the Far Side, right? What's
okay,
the deal
so
with that?
So Paul is like, you find something, bring it to me. And before the Far Side, I found this guy. Just I'm walking down the street and I see a guy from the neighborhood and he's looking at me. He's like, yo, Adrian, I know you're in the record business. Help me get my demo signed. And I was like, you know, I don't know if I can do that, but you give me the tape and I'll see if I can play it for somebody. I know some people over at Tommy Boy. We're working records for them. These guys, Naughty by Nature, had just left L.A. And I was, you know, my cousin and I were taking Tretch and him around. There's a funny story to that, too. I could tell you later. But the guy who walked up on me was Coolio. And I told Paul, I was like, I think you should work with him and yada da. And Paul was just like, yeah, you think? And, you know, at the time, I didn't understand how to manage a group or any of that kind of thing because I call myself managing Daz and his group because Daz is from Tulsa. But I wasn't any good at that. And Daz was like, I'm moving to L.A. to hang out with my cousin.
Rapper Daz Dillinger's cousin turned out to be Snoop Dogg. And Daz would soon be working on the Chronic and Doggy Style and would join Corrupt to form the popular duo, the Dog Pound.
And then I was like, all right, well, you know, we'll be in touch, whatever. I'm going to be in L.A. too. And this is, you know, yeah, it's a crazy.
So you knew Daz what before Dog Pound stuff?
Well, before I discovered Daz when he was in high school rapping. That's my dude to this day. Like, you know, one good thing I've been able to do, and I've looked at this thing as a culture of community, of family. I stay that no matter what. Like, I don't care about artists that I've managed previously or whatever. Most of them will tell you the same thing. I at least try to create this thing as a business from a family perspective. So if we don't do good business together, we can still remain friends till it's no end of it, you know? And that's always been my attitude about it. I've been told several times to still not look at business like that. But, you know, I have to do things my way and not the way that other people do them. So I was involved in this thing called The Good Life. I had helped start this club in L.A. called The Good Life. One of the guys that was in the club at The Good Life where we were doing was a kid named Razzcaz.
John Austin IV, better known to music fans as Razzcaz, is generally regarded as one of the best rappers of all time due to his complex lyricism and heady take on political and historical themes. His 1996 debut album, Soul on Ice, received perfect five-star ratings in both Vibe and Rap Pages.
December 25th, and I thought the birth of Christ was Saturnalia. When men got drunk, fucked each other, then beat their wife. Fact is, it was still practiced till they called it Christmas. So put a gerbil on your Christmas list.
Razzcast kept telling me about these dancer kids.
Right.
As we were bubbling on the hip-hop circuit, there was a whole other, like, trendy circuit in L.A. dancing. And we would all be out at the clubs dancing, having a ball. And then, you know, somebody would start rapping. And, you know, this is the time when you would see people like Jason Sugars, people like Will.i.am. I mean, they were just straight dancers, not rappers. And, you know, it was a real cool scene because it was an underground club scene with the best DJs in L.A. And Raz was one of those dancers. And another dancer was Jammer D. And Trey from the Far Side was also a dancer kid. Like, they were all Far Side were dancers first. And so Raz was like, no, they're dope. They got a thing that they're doing now. And, you know, we couldn't quite get a hold of them. And then Paul finally was like, yo, we're going up to the Gavin. You know, we'll see you guys up in San Francisco.
Hanging out at the Gavin. To hear all about the Gavin Seminar, a convention put on by the Gavin Report Music and Radio Trade Magazine, check out our interview with the magazine's former rap editor, Tembisa M. Shaka, on episode 122.
We get up there and Raz's manager, Lano Brazil, he was just like, hey, I want you and Paul to co-manage this group with me. So Raz, my friend, Lano, my friend, got us in this room and we walked in the room and these guys were jumping around. They were so excited. They were super amped. It was a twin beds in the room and they did Your Mom's, like, jumping around on the beds. Was hilarious. And that just was this kinetic energy. Because at the time, you have to remember, we were up on De La real hard, right? And then I was real cool with the Souls. And this was right before Far Side got signed and did Soul Flower.
The Far Side is coming and I hope we're not whack. But at this point, there's no turning back. But to be exact, I got more flavors in a bucket full of fruit. In 92, we make some cash. In 93, we make the loot because the vinyl was delicious. I'm the nigga who's ambitious. Michael Ross the genie, he's giving us three wishes. One, I want to just jam with your band. Two, you gotta play it all across the land. Three, the plan is grab the duck and then say fuck it to the critics. Hey, now.
So this was an era, it was crazy because it was all like this, again, it was this kinetic energy of positivity and it was our hippie stage. So I had just gotten Freestyle Fellowship signed and I'm getting all these guys signed and I don't know what I'm doing. Like I have no clue that I'm not their manager. I'm not their A&R guy. But luckily for me, everybody saw the spirit that I had and they were really like, hey man, you should think about doing this. You should think about doing A&R. And so I got Freestyle signed and then we're in the room with the Far Side and I'm telling my cousin, I said to him, you know, he was just like, I don't know, man. I'm like, you got to get these guys signed over to Delicious Vinyl. Well, keep in mind, Paul didn't want to sign him to Delicious Vinyl. Paul wanted a real record deal. He wanted to go to like Lisa Cortez over at Mercury.
To hear Lisa Cortez talk about her time at Mercury and more, check out episode 92.
She wanted to do the deal eventually, like they had gotten to the point of doing the negotiation. And I think I pissed Paul off because, well, I know I pissed him off because I told Mike Ross, I went to the head of Delicious Vinyl, the owner, and I was just like, you need to sign these guys.
over Paul's head or without him knowing. Yeah.
You know, I was like, And I told him, I was like, you got to do it now, because if you don't do it now, they're going to go do a deal here. And they want to go here because you have to keep in mind at the time, Delicious Vinyl had all the dope artists, plus the brand new heavies were just starting to bubble super hard. So if you got signed over here, you were with the running team, basically. And so Mike said, talk to Orlando. I don't know anything about those guys. And I talked to Orlando again, and Orlando was like, what does your cousin think? And my cousin was still like hating me out the whole world. Like he was like, uh-uh, they're whack, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I think maybe 2 weeks later, Lisa Cortez hadn't moved on her deal. And Orlando, like, really started filling the record. And he was just like, Adrian, I'm going to sign those guys. I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to put them on this brand new heavy song. And I was like, you got to talk to Paul. I don't manage him, you know, whatever. I'm just trying to get the A&R credit. And then my cousin started coming around, and Orlando had got real busy. He had to go on tour or something. So my cousin stepped up, and he was just like, you know, created a whirlwind nightmare over here for me with these guys. I got to get in the loop now, you know, like, I got to take over. I'm the record company guy. And I was just like, yeah, take over, man. Come on, you got to do it. It's smart. And sure enough, they got them on a brand new Heavies project right before the Heavies went on tour, and it became Soulflower. And that single deal turned into an album option. You know, they got the record deal, and Mike Ross gave them some real paper at that time to make a record. And so you have to remember how they made this Far Side first album was at Hollywood Sound, where my now office is. So this story is going to rekindle itself through where we actually made the recordings of Bizarre Ride.
Wow. Amazing. And so you're getting Freestyle Fellowship signed. I can't believe we just sort of mentioned that in passing. You know, you're getting Far Side. You're, you know, I assume working with Funkdubious somewhere around this point, or was that a little later?
That was a little later. And it's very intrinsic. I got to say that in Paul's house, I mentioned a guy named Skate Master Tate. God rest his soul. Mm-hmm. The man does just do the bass. The man
does just do the bass. Jerry, Skate Master Tate Hurtado was a top amateur skater in the 70s and later became a musician, DJ, and television host. He passed away of cancer in October 2015. Back is the forward attack to open eyes and ears to knock so loud. People hear from the base, they're coming down from above. It's the knowledge, wisdom, peace, and most of all, love.
Taters introduced us all in and around to the beat guys, the guys who were collecting the records. They were, you know, even though Paul had a bit mass record collection, the entire house was set up around Skate Master Tate's record collection. So everybody would come over there and grab records and sneak off joints from him. And one of those guys was a guy named Muggs.
Adrian is, of course, talking about DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill, who joined us on The Cypher in episode 30.
So Muggs was over there hanging out with us. Everlast would come over and be like, listen to my new demo. We were like, nah, you know, but he was a tough guy, so we would always fuck with him. But my homeboy was DJ Lethal, and he was with Everlast all the time.
DJ Lethal, as Adrian implies here, was the DJ in Everlast group House of Pain. After his time there, he would go on to DJ with Limp Bizkit.
So he would come over and, you know, get on the turntables and scratch, and, you know, he was dope. And then Ralph M would come around. So that was the formation, basically, at that place on Gardner, mm-hmm. was when they decided to do a formation of what was to become Soul Assassins. We're pulling strings, killing kings, cutting all pinky rings, seizing control of the whole game.
Soul Assassins is the name for a loose collective of musicians and graphic artists affiliated with Cypress Hill. As Adrian says, some of the earliest members were Muggs, DJ Ralph M of Funkdubious, DJ Lethal, and Everlast.
Far Side get signed, Freestyle Fellowship get signed. I'm working at Hits Magazine doing this rap music chart for Hits that, you know, I later got fired over because they were like, we're not going to do the rap chart anymore. It's not something we want. And then I was like, you know, that's fucked up because, you know, the rap music chart is going to be something you're going to need. But Gavin has one. How you not going to have one? Nah, we don't need it. And they kept doing it after I left. But I created it single-handedly. It was funny, man. And then when I left, I went to Hits to not do a rap music chart. I went to Hits to do radio, national radio. I was just basically collecting data with music directors and program directors and GMs for a guy named Graham Armstrong. And then Graham was a serious, like, dude. Graham gave me my job, Graham gave me the opportunity, and Graham gave me the one thing I didn't know anything about, which was the national radio list. Now, I can't say I did radio promotions, mm-hmm. but I knew where every programmer, where they rested their head, I knew how to get in contact, I knew how to get their list from them on Tuesdays. When that list was due, I knew how to do my job. And getting the list meant I knew what the ads were nationally.
Well, it seems like a pretty good position to do A&R from if you know what songs the radio is adding every week.
And I never put that together. I always said that A&Ring was the creative side of the music. The radio side was something else. You know, I never even equated these R&B guys into my world. And it didn't equate. It wasn't connecting at the time, really. Because, you know, big hip-hop records were rap records. They were rap. They weren't hip-hop. And we were in hip-hop. It was a whole different, you know, it was not the same thing at all. Clearly not. So when I left Hits, I couldn't go back to work for Paul. That just was not going to happen. And so Fabian, who was Paul's roommate in school up in Sonoma, had, you know, we were already close. Like I said, Paul's office was right across the street. Paul's house was across the street from Stephen Rifkin's office. They said, come in here. Steven wants to talk to you. And I went inside, and all Steven said to me was like, hey, you still got the list. And I said, what list are you talking about? And he was just like, the national radio list from Hits. And I just looked at Faye like, you know, this is a setup. I thought you said he had a job for me. And Faye just looked at me like, you know, tell him you got the list. And I had the list, but it was like balled up real tiny in my pocket. And Steve was like, give me the list. And I said, no. And he said, well, you got a job if you can come up with a way to manipulate that list so that we can get our records added. And I was like, you want me to tell people to just play the record? And I knew what an ad was.
Right.
Keep in mind, I was a music director once upon a time. So, but I was playing Steve all the way, egging him on. He was just like, look, I'll make you a street teamer. And I was like, you'll make me head of radio. He's like, all right, I'll make you head of radio promotions. And I was like, and when you start a label, I'm doing A&R. He's like, and when I start a label, you're going to do the A&R. And I just looked at Faye. I was like, all right, I guess I'll work here then. And that's when I went to work for Steve Rifkin.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's so much we could talk about. I wanted to talk about the Immortal days for just a minute. What was that like? It seems like that was kind of like the epicenter of, you know, when all the stuff you were talking about, the Cypress Hill, House of Pain, all that kind of came to fruition right around Immortal.
Because I'm a truth sayer, you're going to get the truth, and you're going to get a lot of that people are going to be, I don't want to say folks are going to get upset about, but it's the truth. So Skate Master Tate had a girlfriend. His girlfriend used to stay on my neck about one day I'm going to go work for her. That day came when Steven Rifkin fired me for like the last time. I was over being fired by Steven. And Amanda Shear, who was Skate Master Tate's girlfriend, was starting her company with Happy Walters. They called it Immortal. It was already Buzz Tone Management. And it, too, oddly enough, was on Gardner. Gardner had banging offices for sale. Yeah, so I went to go work at Immortal and Buzz Tone Management. And that's when, you know, we had House of Pain, we had House of Pain. Right. And Soul Assassins, basically. We had everybody. And we put out Jump Around, and it caught on fire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've talked to Muggs about that record. And Divine Styler, too, what he saw being close with
exactly.
Eric and that whole crew.
Jump Around blowing up, it was just like, it happened so fast that, you know, whoever was affiliated or associated with it just was tripping off the wave or rode the wave until it slowed down. And it was just like, wow, that was a trip. And that's how I viewed it. You know what I mean? It was just like a trip. It was a real trip, man.
Yeah, it took off. And, you know, like my relationship was with Tommy Boy in a real way because of the Coolio project. So I was real close to everybody over there. I had been working records for Tommy Boy through Paul's company for a long time. So I had a really good vibe with everybody over there. And when the record took off, we were helping. Like, it wasn't just Tommy Boy and it wasn't just Warner Brothers. It was the management company. It was Immortal Records. It was tons of us helping push that record that deserved to be heard, to get it heard. Mm-hmm. So right after that, Cypress decided to stick their hands out and say, okay, we're coming now. And, you know, they wanted to be mysterious. They wanted to be, you know, exactly everything they were. Muggs systematically made that. And then they came out and it took a minute for it to connect. But when it did, oh my God, it was like the truth. And then Muggs was like, well, I'm immediately going to put out Funk Dubious. And, you know, Son was Puerto Rican and I'm half Puerto Rican. So we really were. He would come in the office all the time. We always connected. He saw the work I was doing. I thought he was the dope rapper. And we was just always connect with each other. And then Ralph was just, you know, he's a Pisces. I'm a Pisces. We were always like really have this whole Latino heritage thing around one another. And, you know, we were building a real small company. But then Funk Dubious put out Bow Wow Wow. They were the truth, you know, so it just they were following suit with everything. And I was in charge of the rap music department for Immortal. So everything that went out came out through me saying we should do it this way. We should make the vinyl color. We should make sure that our DJs are all serviced ahead of time so that we can have it break down like this. And we should give them packages, tchotchkes, not just T-shirts. You know, all the labels at that point were vying for the top slot. Who was the best independent label? You had big companies. You had Tommy Boy. You had Wild Pitch. You had Cold Chillin'. And all the guys that ran all the companies knew one another. We would trade lists. I mean, keep in mind, like when I was at Hits, I was helping all of them do their jobs real well as the rap music director, right? So there was no love lost. It was like you could call somebody, literally get their radio list because you had a new job.
Wow. One thing I do want to ask, we could spend all day on Immortal. Unfortunately, I have to jump forward a little bit, but I have to ask just for my own teenage satisfaction. You know, back when this came out, I loved it, was the Judgment Night soundtrack.
Every song on the soundtrack to the 1993 movie Judgment Night, put out by Immortal and Epic, was a collaboration between a hip-hop act and a rock or metal band. The pairings included Biohazard and Onyx, Helmet and House of Pain, Teenage Fan Club and De La Soul, and Pearl Jam and Cypress Hill.
What was that project like?
Well, you know, that was something that came across like Happy's desk, and then he asked Muggs, would he produce the whole thing? And Muggs was like, I'm not going to produce the whole thing, but we'll do a couple of songs. And, you know, me working at Hits, I had gotten a guy named Paul Pontius, his job with us at Immortal. And, you know, I remember Happy telling me, he's just like, I'm going to hire him, but if he messes up, I'm going to fire both of y'all. And I was like, he's not going to mess up, dude. He just, give him a shot. He's a good dude. And Paul Pontius, you know, Paul recently signed Meghan Trainor. It's like, Paul is the business now. The funniest shit in the world. He and I both were the responsible parties for bringing in Korn, that we were going to lose our jobs over if they didn't blow up.
Good thing that worked.
It worked handsomely. But yeah. Unfortunately, neither of us got the points we were supposed to get as the A&R guys for it. You know, when they blew up, it was the funniest thing in the world that Mick G, who shot their first video, Paul's best friend, got a chance to really sink his teeth into the video music world. And, you know, he never looked back after that.
Joseph McGinty McGee Nickel would go on to direct a 2000 Charlie's Angels reboot and its sequel, and executive produce TV series like The OC, Chuck, Nikita, and Supernatural.
So, you know, everything was connected to something else from a huge perspective, but we just kind of like created a microcosm out of, you know, so it was kind of interesting. But like Judgment Night, from Dennis Leary having like one of his first acting jobs.
You don't understand shit, okay? Nothing. Guys like you gotta keep checking your pants to see if you got a dick. I got one. You and your friends are the kind of spoon-fed fucking fruit bait that I fucking hate!
I don't think he understood me.
Shut the fuck up! You speak when fucking spoken to, okay? This is not fucking high school, motherfucker! I'll eat your fucking friends for fucking lunch! You know who we are? No, you have no...
She was always at the office, so that was when Amanda started really dating Ted Demme. God rest his soul.
Demme, among many other accomplishments, was the creator of Yo MTV Raps. He would eventually marry and have two children with Amanda Shear before his death in 2002.
So Ted was around a lot, you know, and it was just really super, like, we were in West Hollywood, so the Immortal offices were bananas. We had the dopest office in the business of music, I think, like, for sure. And it was right off of, like, Robertson and Santa Monica Boulevard. But yeah, everybody was coming through those doors. And, you know, when you have a project, when you go from Pearl Jam to, you know, House of Pain, you know, that was off the chain.
Yeah. And I do want to jump ahead a bit to what you're up to now. How did you first discover Anderson .Paak, or I guess Breezy Lovejoy as is his original name?
Well, again, I was just managing acts, looking for underground talent and staying in the business of just paying attention to what the kids like. You know, I was working with two of his friends. They were a rap group. He was doing background stuff for them. And I liked one of the songs, and they kept telling me it was their song. He was the main reason I liked the song. And when I met him, I was like, yo, man, I think you're great. You got some other material. And he started to give me some stuff. And I was partnered in with D'Angelo's manager, and we were looking for the next, like, D'Angelo, for all intents and purposes. And I was like, oh, this kid is pretty close to it. But he had management. They just didn't know how to take him to the next level and do something that would grow him out. And then when, you know, my partner at the time was D'Angelo's manager, he was just like, yo, I can't do it because D'Angelo's going to get offended. And I was like, well, I'm going to get offended if you don't help me. Because yeah, you said you would. And then he said, no, I'm not going to be able to do it. And luckily, like, I get a phone call from F. Gary Gray to do some music for one of his Harley Davidson's ads that he had put together. And I said, okay, you know, I got this song. I think you should hear from this kid. And I played it for him, and he loved it. And it was Anderson's. It was, at the time, it was Breezy Lovejoy's music. And, you know, I went to him and I was like, you interested in having your music positioned in one of F. Gary Gray's projects? And he knew who Gary was, and he was like, hell yeah. And then I talked to his manager, and his manager was like, oh, he's trying to infringe on me. No, absolutely not. And I was like, look, your manager's not interested in this happening, so I don't know what to tell you. So he was just like, dude, you know, help me. And I was like, all right, well, you know, if you want me to manage you, then say the words, and we can go that way with it, because I'm interested. And then that's kind of where we went with it. And then immediately, you know, that guy who I think had really helped him out on a lot of things, he had become a mentor to him, had put him in the position of recording the music that I heard. So I don't want to front on him at all. He just didn't know how to take him to the next wave of things. And it had been a while. You keep in mind, I had kind of backed out the business for a minute after having found Flo Rida and was managing him, and it just couldn't get him a deal. And then he turned around and got signed to the same damn people I had taken him to in the first place. It was one of those like hardships with me in the business of music. So I just like took some time off and went back to school and wasn't really tripping. But when I got back into it again, you know, he and his people were the first kids I had come across. So I basically was just like, let me start a company. You know, my company was Zion, is still Zion. That's the parent company for all the businesses. And I just like try to empower the artists. As a manager, I think that if I empower the people that I work with and for, they're going to be in a position of power that they can later have something to say, hey, you know, he didn't just sign me to him or do it his way. He helped me develop my own business and brand so that we could all grow collectively. And it's so important that everybody has their own outlet and way of doing their business. And that's what I did with AP, with OBE, in creating that as a business.
Mm-hmm. And to the extent you could put it into words, what was it about Anderson that you thought, like, not just, oh, here's a talented guy who can, you know, sing and rap, but like could be a star?
I just really like the music. You know, it goes back to does the music really resonate with me or not? And yeah, it did. And I felt like if people could hear the music that I was hearing, which people still have not heard what I heard out of him, it's just better. It's just gotten better. He's one of the rare moments of music that you can just say, okay, he never makes a bad song. He might not make a song that we want to put out and make it into, you know, a commercial, you know, piece or something. But as far as his art goes, it's always been something that's been my taste. And I've always been a good person to get the voice out to the, you know, people. I've always had the access. So us working together is kind of like a hand in a glove. It's a little easier than the average headaches. And we've always been doing it ourselves independently.
Right. And to that end, I heard a story, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but that in the early stages of working with him, you actually sold your house to help keep his stuff going.
Yeah, man. I mean, I had a beautiful home in Woodland Hills, and I had a beautiful situation here I felt really strongly about, but we just needed the money to keep it afloat. And, you know, I decided that I was going to move anyway, because my girlfriend was like, hey, we should move and get our relationship a little bit more seriously. And I'm just like, dude, I got a big ass house right here. Why would we move? Right. And I would make no plans of selling my house after having just gotten out of the nightmare of everybody's losing their homes, a big mortgage crisis. You know, we all suffer from that. So I had just gotten out of it. I had gotten everything straight with the banks. And, you know, I had a little equity in the home. I had a lot of equity in the home. And I said, you know, if I sell the house, then I'm going to be up and I'll have to worry about like where money's going to come from. And I can honestly put it into some of these projects. Well, by the time I sold the house, I had lost all the other artists that I was working with. And he was still there. And I was like, oh, shit, let's get going. And he was like, okay, well, you know, what are we going to do first? And we just started making music. We created the cover art project. I'm going to fight them all. A seven nation army couldn't hold me back.
Cover Art is a 2013 EP by Anderson of R&B-styled covers of folk and rock songs originally by white artists, envisioned as a reverse homage to white singers in the 1950s who popularized records by black artists.
And, you know, he wanted to rock with a company called Hellfire Club to help us on the marketing tip because he really felt like that kid was connected to the scene the right way. He wasn't wrong when he said that. I made sure that the business wasn't something that tied him up. And so he was the creative to what we were doing business-wise, and I was the business to what we were doing business-wise. But it was always like OBE, and, you know, we're going to grow this business.
Amazing. And so where does Dre enter the picture?
My first meeting, keep in mind, he never met F. Gary Gray back then. That Gary's my friend from you know, growing up in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
The first meeting we went to as a he and I manager to artists was to go find the lawyer. And I took him to meet Dre's attorney, Peter Paterno. So day one, I knew I wanted Dre to be involved with this record. And I always said to myself, if Dre's going to reach out to somebody like a Kendrick and do a record, having no dynamic of understanding what TDE was to Aftermath, I was just like, OBE could be doing a deal with Aftermath. And that was my big, like, picture. And I know that in a million years, he didn't think about working with Dre. But keep in mind, I had worked with Daz, Snoop. I had relationships to Dre because I knew Easy real well back in the day. Terry Heller was a good friend of mine. I knew Jerry Heller very well. When Easy passed away, I was the only guy who got a deal signed to Ruthless Records when I was managing Hobson. So it was a lot of, I know how to get to Dre, but it's got to be syncopated. I knew people who were right next to Dre. I figured, fuck it, let me go to Peter Paterno. Let me just get right in his face off top. And Peter said, I'm not taking this to Dr. Dre. He's not even interested in signing anything right now. But if you guys get it to the point where Dre's interested, I'll vouch for it. And he later kept his word on that.
Were you around for any of the Compton sessions?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was there at all the sessions.
What were they like?
It was, you know, a room full of really creative people. Dre at the helm, you know, going back and forth with Anderson with respect to ideas and coming up with smart ideas. And they would work at Record One, they would work at the Beach House in Malibu. But it was like, you know, when the first thing got done, and Anderson's told that story 25 times to different magazines on how the first thing got going, how he walked in the studio, met Dre and DLC, they played the song and went right to work. It was, you know, a lot of more things going on to get him in that room to Dre. Mm-hmm. But once he got in the room, Dre was like not letting him leave the room. That is definitely the truth.
Right. Were you aware? Like, at what point during the process did you become aware, hey, he's going to have the, like, a really prominent role, kind of the, like, you know, equivalent to Snoop Dogg on The Chronic, the, like, top guest star?
Nah. Nobody would have known that. I don't think we could have predicted that part because it was too many records.
Mm-hmm.
And he hadn't released, there was no like release for, he didn't put out Detox. So everybody was like, is it like Anderson and all the kids? They were like, nah, this never going to come out, see the light of day. The thing that was the saving grace with me is that I had a relationship with Gary, and Gary was doing Straight Outta Compton. And I knew about that from day one. I was building a studio at his house, so I was with Gary every day.
Wow.
So, you know, I had the insight like a mug.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't say anything because I couldn't say what Dre was going to do, but I knew Gary was saying, Dre's getting ready to make that record a reality. Let me get your demos, and I'll take them to Dre for you. And I gave him all the material I had, and Dre just didn't even listen to it from Gary. And Gary was just like, later on, Dre was like, yeah, you did bring it to me first. But, yeah, I mean, like, it was so much music, you couldn't have said, oh, Dre's going to make that record with Ice Cube and blah, 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 blah. And you didn't know it until like the last, I swear, 2-3 weeks when he decided, I need Marshall. I need Snoop. You started to see the famous people come through.
Mm-hmm. And then you knew it was real.
Yeah. You knew it was going out. There was no way around it. And then he made the announcement that how he was going to do it, this, that, and the other. But I had a strong idea that it was going to see the light of day after they had done like 4 songs.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. And so at what point did, you know, Anderson actually becoming sort of more formally affiliated with Aftermath, like, and happen? Like, when did that enter the picture?
I want y'all to say what's up to the new Aftermath representative.
Yes, Lord!
Anderson Paak, baby. Welcome to Aftermath. Bam!
Well, you know, as we were getting further down the line, and I think Dre noticed that he was going to need to, not that he was going to need to do anything with Anderson, but he really wanted to. He felt like Anderson had proved himself. He liked how we moved, I guess, you know, he did say that. He was like, I like how you guys move together. You're not asking me for shit. You just show up. You work hard. You're his manager. You don't even need to be here, but you're here until the sessions are over. And, you know, I just really like what y'all doing. And your man's good. He was just like, how would you guys like to be a part of what I'm doing? And, you know, shit, he just did a $1 billion deal. How much of an idiot are you? You don't want to sign with Dr. Dre. So I'm looking at him and I said, well, you know, it's really his call. You know, he's my partner. And, you know, I don't just manage him. He's my partner. And AP was like, hell yeah, I want to do it. And we did not have, it was a lot of deals that AP had thrown at him that he wanted to sign. And I said, no, don't do it. He's like, why? We ain't gonna get another chance. I was like, trust me, don't do it. And he didn't do it. And because he hadn't signed anything, when Dre asked me, is he signing anybody? I was like, no, Dre. He was like, now when the lawyers get involved and he's got a deal and he's signed to somebody and it gets ugly, I ain't going to fuck with it. And I said, trust me when I tell you, this is something that's super clean and super right. And it was, because everything we had did had been a licensing from the company. And that's because I know what I'm doing when it comes to this business, because I have made enough mistakes for 20 people.
Right.
So, you know, after you make one or two mistakes, it's one thing. After you see 20 mistakes made, it's like, oh, shit, I know what I'm doing now. Exactly. So that was what happened. And then Dre said, well, we're going to do it. And he's like, you're going to be very happy. And I am very happy. And Anderson is very happy. And, you know, with all the support, more than the let me say this about Dre, more than anything else, because he and I, he's, you know, a few years older than me. He's been in this from a different perspective. I have seen a lot of all the sides.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate how he approached us as men, first and foremost, as friends, and then as business. He didn't just say, oh, like, right to business. I want you to drop down, give me 20, and I'm going to give you $2. It was more like, what do you guys want to do? I want to do what you want to do. He's in a different place, obviously, than he's ever been in his life. But, you know, even the Dre and the Aftermath days, I heard nightmares about people signing deals and blah, 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 never seeing the light of day. But he didn't say, I want to hem you up and make it where you can't put another record out.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the approach. And I really appreciated that versus how all the other labels, when they saw Anderson on Compton, when they finally saw he was doable, it was like, you went too late. How are you going to let Dr. Dre put him out and then think I'm not going to do a deal with Dr. Dre, or that he's not going to want to be with Dr. Dre?
Right.
He never did nothing wrong to us. He's only did right by us. So
amazing. And so was Malibu, was that album already done by the time you sort of signed with Aftermath? Was it complete?
Yeah, it was pretty much done, that one, and then the No Worries stuff.
Smooth in the motherfucker. Suede on the inside. Candy paint, candy paint. I ain't gotta tell you what the rims look like. Look, I'm gripping wood like a motherfucker. Woo! She asked me, can a friend ride? Kelly wanna have a drink. And Shawnee wanna pop pills all night. Look, don't be fucking with my tape, Dad. Woo!
He's got about five or six projects that he consistently just like knocks out, and we put them, you know, we knock them down to size through A&Ring the songs, making sure that the right sounds are going with the right records, you know, because keep in mind, it wasn't the way it was. Like, he learned from Dre that 2 week crunch, figure it all out up to the wire, even at the wire, keep making songs until it's done. And so he was picking up, like, he was a sponge in the studio with Dre. I think Dre got that.
Yeah. You know, for you now, like, you know, we've touched on at least, you know, some parts of your career. And we've seen, like, you've discovered people and maybe not gotten the credit you should have tons of times over the years, or managed people and had them sort of blow up after you finish working with them, like just a whole career's worth of ups and downs. What does Anderson's success right now mean to you as someone who's seen so much over the years and been a part of so much?
He would make jokes to me about that shit, too. He would be like, well, you know, how come you ain't doing it now? And I said to him, I think that with your project, we're going to make something that I've been waiting a long time happen. And that's create believers more than just fans. We're going to create a different movement more than just put a record out. And I said, and I don't think I had an artist that was ready for that task. I've been looking for Prince Michael Jackson my entire career. That's why I worked for Benny Medina.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I worked with Quincy Jones. That's why I found a way to work with Dan Charnas, indirectly working with Rick Rubin. I always felt like if I get to the top of the food chain on the work totem pole, I'm a hard worker. I don't know that I work the smartest, but I really wanted to get this thing in a way where, I guess it was a vindication of some sort, you know, like to be able to say exhale. And now that we're in the eye of the storm there, it doesn't look like there's any time to exhale because we're so busy doing things that we love. And so now I'm not tripping off of what happened. That's the past. You know, I can't live in the past. And something that Anderson always tells me, because, you know, that's my little bro right there. We work together like family. But more importantly, I respect him as an artist. He respects me as a businessman. And, you know, I respect his business as much as he respects my artistic, you know, understandings. So we have a really different relationship. You know, people try to compare it to different relationships that have existed in hip hop. And I always try to tell people he's not a hip hop artist. So, A, that's never not what that's going to be. You know, he's an alternative pop artist that just is, he needs that one thing to happen that I think is going to take him over the top. It's not that one song. It's just that I think, you know, for the popular audience to see him, it's something that's going to be a give. And right now, I think we have a lot of things to choose from. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I answered the question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, what I was thinking is it seems like, you know, this is a success that you can truly call your own, you know, kind of, you don't have to share it with anyone. Like, there's no one else sort of claiming credit for it. And I was just wondering how that kind of felt after, you know, like I said, so many ups and downs.
Well, we had a lot of people around us. You know, if I can give a shout out to Peanut Butter Wolf, who was a believer and decided, yeah, I'm going to help and be a part of it. Chris stepped up early. Hellfire Club stepped up early to be a part of what we were doing. Steel Wool, you know, I'm in partnership with Kevin for the two records. He's a good guy. He co-manages AP with me. He's been real helpful. And Art Club, you know, Taz Askew, who owns Art Club with Janae, they came in early and gave us the touring side that I don't think anybody was really tripping off of. So, you know, they really wanted us to shine and get him in front of Janae's audience because she's Asian and he's part Asian. So that's a whole nother wave of things that Anderson brings that I don't think the average rapper has that he can even offer to the table. And that's his heritage.
Interesting. You were thinking about that kind of international appeal from
hell
the beginning.
Yeah. When his first real show that he said, I got, I showed up. It was like 800 Korean kids. And I was like, how in the hell did you get this show? And he was just like, dude, I live in Koreatown. I'm married to a Korean woman. My best friend's Korean. You remember? I'm kind of in that world. And I was like, golly. Okay.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah,
amazing.
Crazy.
One business thing I was curious about, you've had a lot of experience with kind of the first generation of big record company people, right? You've worked with Lenny Waronker and Mo Austin and, you know, Quincy Jones you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
What is that generation of people like? How do they differ from people at record companies, you know, more recently, like people today?
It's very clear. My godmother is Claudette Robinson. She used to be in the Miracles and married to Smokey. And she's, you know, one of the co-writers of one of the biggest, you know, publishing catalogs of history. But that era of Mo and Lenny and that era was all about creative. Our era is all about numbers. You know, kids like to say nowadays, oh, the numbers don't lie. Yeah, they do. Sometimes the numbers aren't honest to what creatively needs to happen. And I do believe that one needs to feed the other. Therefore, it's called the music business, not the business, or not the music. But Mo taught me to always follow your heart. And Benny taught me stay close to the talent, not make money, be worried about how much money you making on your bottom line. That wasn't what they taught. You know, they taught me a whole different thing. And I think that the caliber of being close to the talent and knowing how to be close to the creative and being, you know, innovative with that creativity, that is what's going to take you to launch the next wave of things to come, not how much money you have. How much money you have could give you the access to those individuals with the innovations. So I want to be on the innovator side versus anything else, I think.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of innovation, you know, you mentioned in passing your overarching company, Xion. So what it's X-Y-I-O-N for people who are listening, a sort of nod to generations X and Y. Like what exactly is it? What does it do? How does it connect with your work with music? What other stuff does it do? Kind of what is Xion about?
Well, I consider it a boutique agency that's more of an incubator for the artists and the clients that I work with and for. You know, I've grown as a business manager from just a personal manager. So, you know, there's tons of ways to, you know, and after having just had the conversation of money not being in essence, I'm now going to have the conscious conversation that you have to be conscientious of being fiscally responsible. And that is what takes you to sell 100,000 records and work through that for the rest of your life versus selling a million records and have nothing to show for it in 5 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You are conscientious in being fiscally responsible of the money coming in. Then you have the opportunity to grow yourself exponentially. Not just your business. So you might want to be an investor. You might want to have an opportunity to do small, you know, investments, that things are important to you and your family. You might be about water and land. You might be about, you know, hey, I want to do tea. I want to, you know, I want to do yoga. I want to teach health and wellness. And that to me is, I'm around people like that all day long. So for me, having business conversations and just really being able to track people into my company, you know, Zion stands for the X and Y generation I own. And meaning anybody who wants to be a part of this thing, you can have your own entrepreneurial spirit. You can be an ownership to this. And, you know, because you can start a website on your own energy. You don't have to have money to start a website, you know, and a lot of people want to, oh, I need $1,000 to do a website. Well, I'm sure you can pay that, but you don't have to. And if you really do it correctly, it's linear. So it's going to grow and graduate as you grow and graduate the business of it. And I think that technology is giving us the opportunity to be more innovative. That in turn connects us to the capacity to make more money, which in turn, if you're smart enough with what little you get, you'll have a lot to work with through the future. That's my turnkey solution.
Excellent. So yeah, you've talked about how Zion has a lot to do with, you know, the digital divide and trying to help and deal with that. What did you mean?
I think that, like I said, if you feel you need X amount of money to do something, then that's when you've already crossed yourself out. If you feel like you can do it and you're going to do it and it's going to happen, then you can find the things that are open source, because everybody has a smartphone. So get smart with the phone that you have. At the end of the day, I want to see not just people of color, but people who breathe, people who are human beings, have an opportunity to work themselves into what it is they want to do. Now, I'm not going to say it doesn't take work. Everybody wants a shortcut. Everybody wants to be famous. Everybody wants to do, you know, Instagram fame and this, that, and the other. But forget that they have a real life and there are real responsibilities. And you have to really pay bills. And you have to really pay the taxes. And you have to really be about your diligence on things. I mean, I slip up. I'm not perfect. I'm no Warren Buffett today. But I think the way that Warren got to where he was, and he says this, is that he takes one step at a time. He pays attention to the detail. And when you can be the best at what you do there, it's a little easier to do other things that you're not maybe as strong at. But on the digital divide side, everything is accessible to you. Why would you just not get on a computer, use your phone to take the shortcut?
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And, you know, I do have to ask about one business thing in your past that I came across, you know, just kind of researching about you real quick, which is you had a clothing line for a while.
Oh, my God.
That's the response I was hoping
you
for.
You did your research. Yes, I did. I had a well, you know, it goes back to when Steve Rifkin fired me. I got fired because in hiring this group you may have heard of called the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah, I've heard of them, yeah.
I was let go because I kept badgering him to sign all the members individually. Like, you got to sign RZA. You got to sign Meth. You got to give ODB a deal. You can't just let them go get deals. And he didn't want to hear it. He fired me so hard. But at the time, remember I told you we didn't sleep. There was not a lot of rest going on where we were. I was, you know, my girlfriend and I created a company called AHAT. And so it was a men's apparel, you know, fashion apparel brand that I was very excited about. All the people I was working records with wanted an AHAT. And I was working with Fabian. Fabian did AHATs for Tupac. I was working with Eric Brooks. Eric Brooks did AHATs for Ice Cube. So I was branding my business through the business of what I was doing in a day-to-day and making a halfway side profit. When Cross Colors were going out of business, they had to they weren't going out of business. I'm sorry. They were selling the company. And as they were selling the company, they had to clean up all their outstanding accounting. And I guess in it, they had to clean up any lawsuits. And I was smart enough to do the partnerships like I was doing with the record side, with the clothing side. And I went in business with Nancy Heller. And her son was like, hey, Cross Colors is taking our stuff. Let's file a suit. And I was like, whatever. It ain't whatever. I wasn't tripping off of it. And we filed a lawsuit. And they had to clean up the lawsuit while they were trying to take their company and sell it to a private person, I guess. Anyway, they gave us a nice settlement. And when Steve fired me was the same day I found out that I had gotten a settlement. I didn't I was crying when I got fired. When I went home, it wasn't a day where you could just call me on my cell phone. I didn't have that. It was like texting me. People were texting me. I was ignoring text all day, voicemails, whatever. And then I checked my voice, my text, my beeper. I checked it. And my friend was like, yo, call me, call me, call me. I got some great news for you. And I'm upset. I'm crying. And I called him. He was just like, you know, you got a big check from Cross Colors. From that lawsuit, I was like, what lawsuit? And he was just like, they were still in AHATS, remember? And I was like, yeah, but what happened? And he was just like, he told me that. And I was like, are you kidding me? We've since closed the company down. But the bottom line is I think we made a product that a lot of people rocked and they were into it. And, you know, we did really good with it. So, yeah, I didn't do much more since the hats. It was like T-shirts and stuff for companies, but. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I mean, Adrian, I could talk to you all day. I'm sure you've got a million things to do. Thank you so much for your time. I would love to have you on for a part two. We didn't even touch on your time at Warner Brothers with Benny Medina. We didn't touch on Pistol Grip Pump and feuds with Ice Cube and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, man, you know everything, don't you? Well, I will say this, Sean.
Yeah.
Up until right now, and it's a pleasure to meet you. I thank you for the time as well.
Yeah.
Everything that I'm telling you is the truth. So fact check it. Do what you need to do on it. However, it's all connected. So you will understand that the Benny Medina time is connected to Paul Stewart. You will understand that the Ice Cube feud is connected to the Good Life. It's all connected with me. Like, I don't make this up. And it's crazy how it works. But yeah, by all means, I look forward to the next time we can get together and talk.
I think most people who are aware of Adrian know him because of his connection to Anderson .Paak and because of the very dramatic story of how he kept Anderson's career going by selling his house. But the more you look into Adrian's history, the more you realize that his work with Anderson is only the latest chapter in a long and fascinating book. As you heard Adrian say toward the end of the interview, everything in his career is connected, from playing rap on the radio in Oklahoma, to discovering some of the 90s top West Coast acts, to working for Hits Magazine, to being at Warner Brothers, to guiding Anderson to success. Adrian's story, which in some ways this interview only begins to touch on, gives you a look into how West Coast rap grew into the juggernaut it became. Plus, honestly, I'm still amazed that I got to talk to the person who put the Judgment Night soundtrack together. Join us next week when our guest will be Rusty Jux. The longtime Boot Camp Click affiliate talks about his time as onstage and offstage foil to the late, great Sean Price. He also discusses his brand new albums, being an MC's MC, why he cut down on the cursing, and a whole lot more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even $1 a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
And they did Your Mom's.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Neither of us got the points we were supposed to get as the A&R guys for it.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Wow, I'm playing better music on college radio.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
And I really appreciate how he approached us as men.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
Yo, I can't do it because D'Angelo's going to get offended.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Benjamin Bray.
You have to really pay bills.
And a very special shout out to Dan Charnas for making our conversation with Adrian happen.
He and his people were the first kids I had come across.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Speaking of which, he wants me to cancel a lot of his press today, so I got to go put that fire out.